welcome to Turn the Page, the official podcast of the Syosset Public Library.
Hello, I'm Jen, and this is Turn the Page, the official podcast of Syosset Public Library. And I'd like to introduce you to this week's guest. Could I ask you to introduce yourself and your book in your own words?
Sure. My name is Danielle Cebulski. I'm a historian and podcaster too. My new book is How to Live Like a Monk, Medieval Wisdom for Modern Life. And it's a weird intersection of history, self-help, and wellness. So yeah, it's a good book. And thank you for having me to talk about it. It's a pleasure.
Oh, thank you for being here. It's really a delight. I loved this book. I thought it was so much fun. It was a really great overview of medieval monasticism while also being like a really, I think, useful primer, you know, full of everyday tips for kind of for living your best life.
Good. I'm glad you liked it.
I was wondering if we could start with a little bit about your background, what you've researched and what you've written before, and how you came to write this book.
Okay, so I came to medieval studies through literature. So my degree is actually in English literature. I have a master's degree from University of Toronto, but I took as many classes as I could in medieval history. And it was kind of a toss-up between where I was going to get my degree, what I was going to get my degree in, either medieval studies or English, but I thought there would be more jobs in English. And it turns out that my career has actually gone in the other direction. So I've done a lot of writing for the internet. I've been a contributing writer for medievalist.net since 2013, I think. I started my own blog, and then that was picked up by medievalist.net. And I started it as the 5-Minute Medievalist. And the idea behind it was to just introduce people in a friendly way to the stuff about medieval history that they might not already know. So I started writing that. And so my articles are still there. I think there's something, someone counted ones, and I think there's something like 200 articles on medievalist.net that I've done. Yeah. So my first book was a compilation of those articles with a couple extra ones for people who wanted to buy the book. And that one is just called The 5-Minute Medievalist. And then after that, I did a really small one kind of just for fun. Again, in my usual wheelhouse of trying to bring people to medieval studies from interesting places. And that was The 5-Minute Medievalist Guide to Surviving the Zombie Apocalypse. So right. that was little, that was fun to write, but it was all about how to use the things that people were using back in the day in case we ever had a zombie apocalypse, we didn't have electricity and all those things. So that was my second book. The third one was Life in Medieval Europe, Fact and Fiction, which I wrote in 2019. It came out, and that was a book that I had wanted to do for years, which is just kind of an introduction, again, a really friendly and short introduction to medieval history in general, at least European history. And I had hoped it would be a book that you could just read start to finish and enjoy, or that you could leave on the shelf for when you're watching Game of Thrones or something and you're like, hang on, what was that really about? So you could take that one off the shelf. So after that one came out, I was actually approached by Abbeville Press about this book. They were familiar with my work, all the stuff I had done about kind of bridging that gap between what people know and what they don't know and modern life and all of that stuff. So this was an idea that they had. How to Live Like a Monk. And then we were in discussions about it, what they thought the book should be, what I thought I could do with the book. And we were just having all these discussions about living like a monk and visions behind what this book was going to be. And then we all started having to live like a monk because that was right before March 2020. So, you know, a lot of this book was written in lockdowns and quarantines and that kind of stuff. So that informs the book. But it was an idea that was brought to me that I thought would be really fun, give me a chance to learn about monks a little more and to tell people about all of the wellness stuff that I had learned about kind of on the side for many years. So that's how the book came about.
Oh, how interesting.
Yeah.
So your book provides, like among many other things, a really fascinating overview of medieval monasticism. And what I thought was really interesting was that you called the Middle Ages the most iconic period for monastic life. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if you could speak to this a little bit about why the monastery was so central to medieval society and why perhaps that lifestyle appealed to so many in the Middle Ages.
Yeah, well, it's funny that you picked that quote out because we actually went back and forth a little bit between me and the editor and the copy editor. Like, do we want to use the word icon when we're talking about the Catholic Church? But I wanted to use that word for a bunch of reasons. I think it's important to have a word that has that religious connotation with this. And when we think about icons, it's both that image that we have of monks. So when we think about monks today, we're not thinking about the ones that are wearing modern street clothes. You know, we're thinking about the ones who are wearing robes. So I was thinking about icon in that perspective, but also these were the people that were looked up to at the time too. So I was thinking about that as well when I was thinking about medieval monks being iconic. So I think it's interesting that you picked that word out. You know, trust a librarian to close read. But so monasticism appealed to people in the Middle Ages for a whole bunch of reasons. One of them, a very basic reason being that was a place where you could have food and shelter, right? So it appealed to the poor and it ministered to the poor in a lot of ways. So I think that might have been one of the ways in which people encountered monasticism was through poverty or through hospitalization, perhaps. And so that's how they encountered monks and thought, you know, this is a good lifestyle. It's a worthy lifestyle. So that was something that appealed to people on a very basic level. You know, you can get your three square meals a day. Actually, they only had two. But you could get your meals, you could get your shelter. So that was one thing. Another thing that appealed to people was the fact that monasticism was a way to get an education. So a lot of people encountered it that way. As children, they might grow up being educated by the church, taught to read, taught about science, and all that kind of thing. And so people who were educated by the church might continue on being educated as monks because they did go to university even as monks. You know, you might take your vows and still be sent to university and continue to learn, bring that knowledge back with you to the monastery. They were also the people that, at least in the earlier part of the Middle Ages, did most of the copying and distribution of books. So there's that. So there's education. And people would often come to the monastery as a place where they could just have, you know, refuge from quote unquote real life and live with books. This is something that a lot of women did as widows. Once they had kind of finished their life as a married woman, a wife and a mother, they might go to a monastery because this is a place where they might have in some ways more freedom and they could continue an education that maybe they had started in childhood. So there's that. But the biggest reason people decided to become monks was because they were devout. They wanted to be monks. They wanted to serve God because that was the highest calling. So the monks were people who, for the most part, removed themselves from society. I say for the most part because they did do things like helping the community or working in hospitals. So they weren't completely isolated all the time. But this is a way you could serve God, the highest calling you could have, except for being a hermit. And we all know that it's very difficult to be a hermit. So this was the best option for people who wanted to serve God with their whole lives. And that was really what appealed to people the most. And we have sources that are in the book too that say this is the reason people want to become monks is because they're devout. And that's really what it comes down to.
Yeah, that's a great answer, and I think it speaks to you know, I think one of the biggest kind of modern day misconceptions perhaps about medieval monastic life is that people were really only there against their will, like if they were a childhood oblate, like if they were given to the church, or if they were a younger son or a unmarriable daughter, like, and I think that it could be hard for modern people to grasp that there could be like pragmatic reasons that exist side by side with like actual devout piety, you know?
People were given to the church as children, especially in the earlier part of the Middle Ages. As you're saying, oblates are children that are given to the church. But even during the Middle Ages, they're like, well, these kids don't have a choice. So they shouldn't really be monks or nuns because they never got to choose this for themselves. And actually, in the Middle Ages, they really had an emphasis on choice when it came to big decisions, especially the sacraments, you know, becoming a monk or getting married. You needed to have your own opinion behind it, you need to consent to that yourself. So, yeah, it wasn't like I mentioned, I think in the book I put it as a ritual sacrifice, which it seems to be in, you know, media. You just sacrifice your children to the monastery, but that's not how it was.
So I know this is a huge question,
Uh-oh.
but I was wondering if you could perhaps quickly take us through what an average day in the life of a medieval monk or nun would look like. Like what rituals kind of marked out their day, what duties, what obligations they had, stuff like that.
This is a big question. Okay, how to do this quickly? There's a lot of interesting things about this. So the major markers of the day are the canonical hours, and those were the times when the monks were supposed to be in the church and they were supposed to be praying. So that happened many times over the course of the day. In between that, they had a bunch of stuff to attend to. So they would have a meeting in the chapter house every morning that would go over monastic business. So what people might not realize is that monasteries often owned a whole lot of land. And so they would have to make decisions about land that they owned. They had to make decisions about the church, the finances. The abbot also had to kind of police the monks' behavior in their chapter meetings. So they had meetings in the morning to deal with business, which is, like any other group of people, they have to have these discussions together. And then they would do work. And a lot of the stuff in this book, my book, is based on the rules of Saint Benedict, because that was considered basically the gold standard. He had all these rules, and everyone would kind of work around those to build their own monasteries. And so, in the rule of Saint Benedict, he mentions that everyone should work, but they should work at the things that they are good at, that they're capable of doing. So, if you are somebody who was good at copying, maybe you had a steady hand, that would be what you'd do. If you were somebody who maybe was raised as a farmer and then joined the monastery, you might be taking care of plants. If you were a person who maybe had an education and then joined the monastery, maybe you'd be taking care of medicine. So everybody would have work to do, and it would all be related to their talents and skills and what they were capable of. So, like, as you got to be older, they wouldn't give you as much difficult work, for example. And then everybody would read. Everybody would read. Saint Benedict was really firm on this, that everybody should read, especially on Sundays. So it kind of goes hand in hand with the education stuff I was talking about. They would be reading from holy texts, but they would also be reading about different things. They might be reading about what the ancient Greeks thought about this or that medicine or even natural philosophy. So they would be reading and educating themselves. And this was kind of on. They were given their books based on what it was necessary for that particular monk to learn, right? So it wasn't, a curriculum so much as it was personalized. And the librarian would be taking care of that and actually recording who had which books, which ones were loaned out. And then reading was also important when they had their meal times. So they might have one big meal during the winter months because it's shorter. They might have two big meals during summer months because the day is longer. And during those meals, everybody was meant to be silent and they would be listening to a brother read. So these are the major markers of the day. There's work, there's praying, and there's eating. And then in between, you might have a bit of a break where you could kind of wander the grounds or contemplate on your own, but you were supposed to be silent most of the time. We know that in real life, people were having chats and, enjoying time with each other and gossiping and, sneaking cats in to pet them and stuff like that. So it wasn't all as the rules say it's supposed to be, but those are the general parts of the day.
Great, thank you. That was a really excellent overview.
Thanks.
And I think that one of the points that you made spoke to another really interesting point that I think the book makes is that, we tend to think of the medieval monastic life as being very, cut off, very, cloistered. That's where the word comes from. But really being in a monastery meant that you were a part of, actually a vast interconnected network where there were ideas and people and objects that were traveling like long distances.
Yeah, so you not only had a monastic community that could have dozens or even hundreds of people, and those people would all have different life experiences, so you could learn from them and talk to them, maybe on the sly if it was during a time when you're supposed to be silent. So there's all that background. We also have those tenants, like I was talking about, the farms where the monastery would own it and the tenants would work it. So they would often have interactions with them. You'd have brothers that were going out to help people. Sometimes they ran hospitals, not always, but it was monks that would do that. So they would have interactions with people in that way. Like I said, they might go to university and come back, meet people. And then there's always people on the road too. So one of the things I mentioned was that monks were supposed to minister to the poor and also travelers. So you'd have people who were traveling maybe to visit the monastery to venerate a relic or something, to see a saint's tomb. And so those people would be visiting too. And so there was a whole bunch of ways in which they would interact with the outside world. Now, that's supposed to be minimized. It's supposed to be, you know, the brother who's at the gate and the abbot and perhaps some of the servants that are really interacting with the outside community. But it's not as closed off as we might imagine.
So one of the reasons why I love this book so much is because it's not, you know, just an overview of medieval monastic life, but it's also a book about, and to quote the book, on how medieval monastic practices can inspire us to live fuller lives, end quote. And I was wondering if there was a particular historical figure or event or perhaps primary source that led you to think about what the tenets of medieval monasticism had to offer us in the present day?
I'm not sure that there was a singular source. It's just something that I'm always thinking about. So I'm always thinking about how human beings haven't really changed over several thousand years. And so I'm always imagining myself in these situations, like in the Middle Ages. One of my favorite centuries to study is the 14th century, which is full of disasters. And that's because I am curious about how people dealt with disaster. So in the same way, I was thinking about actual human beings that I know or have met or can imagine what it was like for them to live a monastic life. And so a lot of the challenges that monks faced, things like getting up in the middle of the night to pray or eating food that was maybe not as exciting as they were having in court, or having to have like 40 fish days of Lent, like what is that like for people? So this is something that I'm always thinking about just in the background. So when this idea of how to live like a monk was brought to me, all of these connections just kind of fired up in my brain, because I'm always thinking of that human element. So it worked for me because I'm always thinking on that level.
And I think that like that adds to sort of the richness of the history as well, because I think we're often, you know, let me sidetrack a little bit. One of the one of my favorite medieval history professors, while she was teaching, especially about monasticism, she was an expert in female monastic life. And she would often ask us to sort of engage our senses when we imagined what medieval people experienced. And I think that really makes history come alive in a way that you remember that, oh, these were actual people who lived these lives and not just names on a page, or, you know, it brings it to life in a really interesting way.
Yeah, that's exactly how I think of it, where history books will teach us things, and of course you have to organize them in some way, and they will teach us by showing a big event, like this is a big event that happened in, you know, 1066 or something like that. But we know that human beings live moment to moment, like minute to minute. How many thoughts are going through our heads when your entire day is a monastic day, where you know you're going to be praying the same prayer, and then you're going to be eating something that's pretty similar, and then you're going to be doing the same work every day? Like, what thoughts are going through your head moment to moment? So I think it's always a rich way of looking at of history like that. So I'm really glad that your professor was on board with that, really engaging all your senses, because yeah, these are people that are living moment to moment, like what's happening in their 60 seconds. So that, yeah, that's how I think of history as well.
So I really liked, I thought the way that you made connections between, you know, medieval monastic life and modern day wellness movements was really interesting. And for instance, you link current minimalist trends to the monastic rejection of earthly attachments. Mm-hmm. Why was it so important for medieval monks to reject personal possessions beyond what was, you know, absolutely necessary? And what benefits do you think minimalism have to the inhabitants of modern society?
Wow, big questions, big questions. Well, this was kind of the thing that surprised me when I was doing this book. I know that monks did a lot of things that wellness experts tell us are good for us, but the reasons behind it are the real mind freak, right? Trying to bring these things together, because monks didn't want to have a lot of possessions because they tied them to the real world, which is a fallen world. So that made them greedy, it made them prideful, and all of the things that are kind of trappings of the physical world are things that might take you from God. So that's the reason that they didn't want to have those things. They really were trying to smooth out the way so that they could contemplate their holy missions and the things that they were aiming for, which was salvation. So in the same way, when we have too much clutter, it can really clutter up our minds too. It can really distract us. It can take up our budgets, all of these things. And so that kind of brings it together. So while the reason that we might reject stuff now are not because stuff is inherently sinful. They thought stuff was inherently sinful. We don't think that. But a lot of the same reasons around having it take up our focus or just make it difficult to do the things that we want to do. Like, I mean, if you take the extreme example of hoarders, it makes every part of their life very difficult, from like physical movement to like having concentration. So the movement of minimalism now is still kind of the same thing, where you're trying to just get rid of all the things that distract you from what you want your focus to be. And so as I was writing this book, like, I don't have any judgment about what anybody's focus is going to be. If your focus is on career achievement, that's great. If it's on family, that's fantastic as well. So if the way to help you keep your focus on what your goal is by streamlining through minimalism, well, that's actually very monastic. So it's something that I have done too. I mean, I think we all read The Life-Changing Magic of Tidying Up, right? We all read that. And I thought that a lot of the same type of things are in it, right? We don't have to hold on to something because it was useful for us, in a past life that we had. And in the same way, monks got rid of the things that were not useful to them in a past life. But at the same time, monks are very much like us, where they still try to hold on to those things. So, like I said, they might smuggle in a cat as a pet, or they might have a seal, which is something I talk about as a way to guarantee borrowing money because they want to use money to buy something for themselves. So it's a very difficult thing to live in a minimalist way. It was a challenge for monks. It's a challenge for people trying to do this today. But I think the underlying idea of being able to focus and kind of streamline your life to head you in the direction that you want to go, which for us might be whatever goals or values we have. For monks, it was salvation. I think that is a core thing that is similar to us as humans across the centuries.
Yeah, I was really struck by the way in which the shape of our lives has changed so much, since the lives that these monks and nuns were living, but that the concerns are very much the same. Like the goals of the behaviors that they undertook and the rituals that they adapted were all about like eliminating distraction, like you said, and cultivating focus and intention. And I found that very poignant, that like our lives can be so different, but that, human beings are still sort of after the same things and struggling with the same sort of, distractions and stuff like that.
Yeah, exactly. And this kind of the book came to me at a time that was good for me, because as I mentioned to you, I like to read about wellness. I like to read about psychology, like what are humans like, and the things that we've learned through psychological testing, for example, really validate a lot of the things that we've done in the past in order to create focus, right? So, you'll have psychological studies saying if you have an uncluttered life, well, you might be able to focus on this better. Or if you have purpose in your life, you'll be happier. If you have a good community, you'll be happier. And so it's a happy thing for me, I was gonna say, happy thing for me to have these things brought together, because we can now show through science and through testing that these things are true over time, which is very exciting, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. So I have one last question for you, and this is a question that I like to ask all the historians that I interview. In the course of researching this book, you treat a lot of different primary sources. And I was wondering if you had a favorite anecdote or story or image that you encountered while you were writing this book.
Well, that's a really good question. The primary sources I used for this one, I kept pretty streamlined because it's a very small book and I didn't want to overload it with, sources. So I really kind of stuck to the rule of Saint Benedict, the observances of Barnwell Priory, which is a bunch of friars, but they live a cloistered life too. And then the Ancren rule, which has had different lifetimes as Ancren Nowitha and stuff like that. So I used this one translation, which I liked, but that was the most fun source, I think, because it was very real and very raw in a lot of ways, where it's talking about, hey, don't get yourself sick, because then you're not going to be able to do what you're supposed to do. Make sure that you eat enough. And I also really like this source because anchorites. So these are people that have enclosed themselves in a room or maybe two rooms attached to a church, and they're hermits for life. That's their entire life. So they are an extreme form of monasticism. But at the same time, there was a whole lot of flexibility in the Ankarin rule where they were saying, you know, take care of yourself, make sure you read. And sometimes it said things like you should spend more time reading than praying at times, because reading makes you happy, and when you're happy you do better work for God, so you will pray better if you read more. And so that kind of thing I thought was really exciting. So I have a lot of quotes from the Ankarin rule sprinkled out throughout that I found were ones that really got at the human element. It also has lots of really great illustrations that I couldn't put in there. And then at the end, I think it was written by a bishop, and he says, well, I hope that you've learned something from this, because it's taken me a long while to write it and I'm not going to write it again. So hopefully you find this useful. I'm out. So it's just like this really religious text, but it was just so human, and like it's got complaints and it's got things saying you should be flexible in how you actually pursue this really extreme goal. And so it's a really interesting text. And I picked this one that's free and open source, so if people want to read that for themselves, they can.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, I think that's a really that's a really important thing, I think, is that to lead your audience to texts that they can investigate themselves. I think that's like a very exciting possibility.
Yeah, it's this particular translation's out of copyright, and so are the observances of Barnwell Priory. So these are things that you can just follow the notes, follow the recommended reading, and you can read them for yourself.
Great. Well, I'd like to thank you for coming to discuss your book with me and our listeners. This has been Jen with Turn the Page Podcast in discussion with...
I'm Danielle Sabolsky. Thanks for having me, Jen.
Thank you. And for now, we are going to close this chapter.
It's time to close this chapter of Turn the Page. Join us for the next episode.